just want to know. I need a heads up. He listens to these things, I'll tell you what. I got thinking about it when I was sitting there, and I think the first time I spoke here, it would have been 8 years ago, probably next month, because Seth had just been born, and that was the first time I ever spoke here, and Pastor Murray and Pastor Bixel both sat on stage the whole time, which completely freaked me out. And Pastor Murray has never been back to hear me since, you know? So how about that? I was like, huh, that's kind of special. We haven't heard much from him. Hopefully everything's okay. I heard from him right after he left, maybe 3 days after he left. He obviously thinks I can work miracles. He sent me a picture he took of a creek flowing out of the mountains, and he thought the water was too muddy, and he wondered if I could make it clear. And I can edit pictures, but I can't work miracles, but I still gave it a shot. This morning we're going to be looking at a pretty familiar passage to us in Joshua, and I threw a title out, and I was going to put insert cool title here, but Brenda wanted a real title, so I said, okay, we'll go with subtle movement. And I was thinking about subtle movement because it's kind of what's going on here. And when I think about subtle movement, I think about clouds, and I absolutely love clouds, and it's working out really well living in Pittsburgh. Because we're the third cloudiest city in all of America, we get 306 cloudy days a year. I thought it was extreme when I first moved here. I was like, no, it's not that cloudy. No, it really is. But I love time-lapsing clouds, and a lot of times I just take my phone out and time-lapse them because typically we see clouds, we don't really see them moving. But I love the way they dance and they churn, and our eyes don't really pick that up, typically because we don't look that long. We just kind of notice them, move on about our day. But I love storm clouds as well, because storm clouds, I mean, they're like scary and awesome all at the same time. But they produce rain, they produce lightning, and I just love it. I love watching them. I've almost been hit by lightning a few times now, so I'm trying to lay off that a little bit. But but I absolutely just love clouds because of the subtle movement. And sometimes when it's really windy around here, you can just see the clouds blowing by, but you don't always see them churning like this. Because if you really watch, though, you can, but you have to focus completely on the cloud. You need to remove all the other distractions and just look at the clouds and just watch. And for a lot of us, that's not going to happen because we're very distracted people. We don't focus that much. And as a result of that, a lot of us miss the more subtle things in life. We miss the subtle movements. And sometimes we miss the subtle things that God is doing in our lives. And this morning, as I said, we're going to look at Joshua 2, and we're going to kind of take a look at what God is doing. And I'm just going to give you a heads up now. I didn't make any more PowerPoint. I think I have two more slides, okay? So it's going to be nice and easy. I don't like to commit. Once you make a PowerPoint, you're committed. I'm a spirit-led guy. I don't like committing. So my question for you this morning, though, is God doing something big in your life that you're totally missing? And we're going to look at this passage, and for time's sake, I'm not going to read the whole passage. We're just going to kind of look at some different sections of it. And Brenda asked me, she's like, "You're doing all of Joshua 2?" And I was like, "Maybe. I don't know. We'll see how far we get." But Joshua 2, it's a pretty familiar story to us with the spies going out and checking out the land. But the first thing we're going to look at is the people. Just kind of break it down, the characters involved. And the first one is Joshua. Now, you probably saw that one coming. Believe it or not, he is the author of the book of Joshua. Probably some mind-blowing information. But his name means Yahweh is salvation. And something we don't always think about was he was born in Egypt, and he has been with the Israelites the whole entire time. So he was Moses' right-hand man. And after 40 years of wandering around the wilderness, he's finally ready to lead Israel into the promised land. The next guys we're going to kind of look at are the spies, and we're not given names, but when you think about it, they must have been two guys that Joshua really trusted and had a lot of confidence in. And there is theories out there that one of them might have been a guy named Solomon, and we'll kind of get to that later. But the last character of this story is Rahab the harlot, and this is an interesting one. Rahab's name, it's kind of broken up with the Ra, was the Egyptian god of the sun. Her name means insolence, fierceness, broad, or spacious. So her parents must have really loved her to name her Fierceness. Wow. Now, there's two Rahabs you see in the Bible. There's Rahab the harlot, and then sometimes in Psalms, Rahab, the word Rahab appears. That's actually used as it's kind of a description of Egypt. And apparently, I read a lot of commentaries the last couple of weeks. Apparently, that Rahab was the mythological monster of chaos. This is not the same Rahab. This is Rahab the harlot. And it's interesting because I've heard the idea tossed out that was she a harlot or was she an innkeeper? Well, you could probably make a little bit of an argument for her being an innkeeper if you only went off the passage in Joshua. But Rahab also appears in Hebrews 11 and James 2:25. So it's kind of hard to deny her being a harlot or a prostitute when you compare the two words. And the Hebrew words, and I always give this disclaimer to the teens, I have no problem slaughtering Hebrew or Greek. I just go for it. Why not? But the Hebrew word is, I believe it's pronounced like zona. At least that's what it looked like to me, zona. And then the Greek word is porne, and both refer to her as a prostitute. So that's kind of the people in the story who we're going to be looking at. And the first thing I kind of want just you to think about is when we talk about God doing subtle things in our lives, what about the people that he's placing in our lives? Do we trust God that he knows what he's doing with the people he's placing in our lives? Because sometimes people pop up that you're not real fond of, and you don't really click with right away. And you might kind of deem them to be a little burdensome or just frustrating, but God might be using them as some of the more important people in your life. I know for me, that's how I met my wife. I've been praying that God brings me a wife. That sounded wrong. I'm sorry, Casey. Wow. That was smooth. I'm glad she loves me. Now, I had been praying that God bring someone in my life. I had been taking classes. I'd go into classes and scope it out for suitable candidates. And I had honestly just given up. And we had a guy show up at work one day that I literally walked straight to the office and talked to my brother-in-law who was kind of in charge at the time. And I was like, what were you thinking? Why did you hire him? Long story short, I ended up meeting Casey through him. So at the time, I was like, this is a dumb move. Why'd you put him here? And then they're like, well, we're going to send him with you because you can straighten him out. And I thought, oh, yeah, thank you. God uses people in ways we never see coming. He does it in a very subtle way. So don't be too quick to judge the people in your life and why God put them there. But is God doing something really big that you're totally missing? Well, let's check out the places in the story, okay? So the first place we're going to look at, and I actually have a slide for this, is Shittim. And Shittim was approximately 7 or 8 miles east of the Jordan River. So I actually, you know, kind of mapped this out. And now, in a lot of commentaries and Bible maps and things like that, you can find these maps of the Old Kingdom, but they're like these little black and white drawings that just, they don't click with my head. So I went ahead and pulled this up on Google Earth, okay? So this is a modern day current picture. It's not live time for any of you who ever thought that. I actually had someone comment on that once. Like, wait, so if I go outside right now, would it show me? I'm like, no, it's not. No, that's not how it works. This is Google Earth. So that's the north end of the Dead Sea. And I left Jerusalem in the picture to kind of give you a gauge of where everything is. So Shittim was about 7, 8 miles east of the river. And then Jericho was on the other side of the Jordan River. It was about 7 miles west. So we're talking about 15 miles in between. Now, Jericho, where it currently is not actually the same site as modern-day Jericho. And I have one more slide, and we're all done for the day, so it'll be real easy for them. Okay, so this is, I zoomed in on Jericho, and because of technology, I even made it 3D, so you could see where the ancient Jericho was. Ancient Jericho was kind of butted right up against the mountains. And one thing I never knew before is this city was not very big. I always tend to think of it as like huge city, or for those of us who've been tainted by VeggieTales growing up, that they had the walls and they were throwing like Slurpees off the walls No. Okay, so just to give you an idea of how big it was, and again, I read so many commentaries, and I was like, where do these people get this information from sometimes? But I kind of take an average, and then I always like default to Charles Ryrie or John MacArthur. I think, okay, they're going to be accurate. So it was approximately 6 to 8 acres in size. So it was tiny. Now, to put that in perspective, that's about the same size as the property we have on this side of the road. Like, if you kind of went down the road, back to the parsonage, out to the shopping center, and then out to 119, that's not a very big city at all. But Jericho was the gateway city to Canaan, because it was kind of the one that sat at the base of the mountains. And it's interesting because we know where the ancient one was, because apparently in 1907, some German archaeologists, and I totally practiced saying that word last night, I was like, I'm going to slaughter that. The German archaeologists unearthed what they believed to be ancient Jericho. So we have Shittim, we have Jericho, and then we have Rahab the harlot's house. Now, it's kind of interesting to me because the story just jumps right in. And it says, then Joshua the son of Nun sent two men to spy secretly from Shittim, saying, go, view the land, especially Jericho. So they went and came into the house of a harlot whose name was Rahab and lodged there. I got thinking, how on earth did they find this house so quickly? So I'm like reading all these commentaries, and I can't believe all the different ideas or theories people have, but some said that she would have had a thread hanging out her window already that advertised her business. Some threw out the idea that it was kind of like a bed and breakfast with negotiable other features, so to say. That would have been near the city gate. Or some tossed out the idea that they thought it was probably to the northwest in the back of the city and what they would have kind of deemed to be like the low rent district. And their theory on that is because of its location, it would have been right up against the mountains, which if you look at the whole story actually would make sense, but that side would have been more vulnerable to attacks. So we don't know exactly how they knew. It doesn't tell us in the scriptures. I don't like to toss things out as fact if I can't actually show it from the scriptures. However, regardless of that, that's where they ended up. And I started thinking, man, how about all the places God has taken me over the years? Because there's places that I'm just like, what was I thinking? Things that still haunt me to this day, poor decisions, things like that. And what about those places that God took you that you didn't really approve of? Like your work, you wish you had a better job, or you wish you lived in a bigger house, or sometimes you think it'd be better if you went to a different school for the younger people. It's crazy. Sometimes our limited vision leads us to think that we're somehow missing out on something better. And I had a thought with this. Can't let your location determine your motivation in life. Don't let your current status limit your obedience to God. Because God has you where you are for a reason. I joked about Pittsburgh and the clouds. Man, it seems like an eternity ago now. But 10 years ago or 9 years ago when we came on staff with Word of Life, and I remember the day they were going to assign us all to locations, and I had heard talk of the different options. I heard Florida was on the table, and Chattanooga, Tennessee, and I'm not real big on the heat in Florida, but I'm thinking, oh, this would be so exotic, you know, to be a missionary in Florida. And it was our turn to go. We sat in front of the board, and they're like, we're sending you to Pittsburgh. And I just like, where is Pittsburgh? I had to get out the maps and look. I didn't even know. And at the time, it just seemed so like, wait, what? That's not in Ohio, right? We were so happy it wasn't, by the way. And it's funny because, you know, we got here and all of a sudden we're meeting people that we just love. We moved down here specifically, and I remember everyone from Irwin joking, you're moving to Fayette County. Why don't you just move to West Virginia? And I've got my friends back. I do not make the West Virginia jokes, man. I love West Virginia. I'm like, what? You know? Well, we are a little bit from the sticks in Michigan. It happened to be a really, really good fit. At the time, I thought, Lord, so wait, that kid's going to the beach and I'm going to Pittsburgh? Why? Sometimes we think we know where we should be. We think we know what's best for us. And God has us stuck somewhere that just seems like, man, why are you doing this to me, Lord? Don't limit what God's doing. Because sometimes God is doing something really big in our life that we're totally missing. So I kind of want to take a look at the sequence of events here. And it starts out, I read the first verse, the spies were sent secretly. That's the first thing it says. It says, then Joshua, the son of Nun, sent two men as spies secretly from Shittim. See, a little bit before that, there was kind of an infamous occasion where Joshua went on the first spy mission. And Joshua and Caleb came back with a great report and said, let's go. Everyone else said, oh, everyone's so big. We're going to lose. We're going to die. It didn't go so well. Joshua obviously learned from the past. After 40 years of wandering in the desert, he remembered how it went the first time. So this time he thought, you know what, this time I'm not going to let everybody know that we're sending spies in. Because if they come back with a bad report, we can leave it on the lowdown. We can kind of regroup and everything. Now, it might seem a little confusing because the end of verse or chapter 1 tells us that Joshua goes and he rises up in front of the people and he says, in verse 1:11, he says, pass through the midst of camp and command the people, saying, prepare provisions for yourself, for within 3 days you are to cross the Jordan and go in to possess the land which the Lord your God is giving you. So based on that, it's pretty good thought that chapter 2 actually probably happened before that. And basically, it's some pretty easy mathing that you do to come to that conclusion, because they were traveling, like I said, from about 8 miles east of the Jordan River to 7 miles west on foot. So that's like walking from here to Starbucks in Greensburg, approximately. Like if you walked all the way up 119 to the Route 30 exit, that's about the distance we're talking. And we also know that after they escaped, they waited 3 days before they went back. So there was at least 4 days we're talking about. So the events here took place before chapter 1. But we see the spies were sent in secretly, and the spies went, let me read the verse exactly. So they went and came into the house of a harlot whose name was Rahab and lodged there. Now, I kind of talked about how they knew what it was, but I kind of want to toss a different question out, and that's why on earth were Joshua's top guys, his go-to men, going to the house of a prostitute? Like, maybe I'm broken, maybe I'm just a little too human, but that was the first thing I thought of, like, what were they doing there? Like, hold on. All right, so I started looking into this. Now, different theories, again, and I'm calling them theories because I don't know exactly from the scriptures, different theories and historians have tossed out ideas of why they would have gone there. And I actually think they're pretty spot on with this, because if it was an inn with added features, you know, other optional things you could purchase there, it would be a place that travelers would come and go on a regular basis. So people, foreigners from Jericho, would come and go from her house, and they could kind of sneak in there without anybody really noticing. Now, another interesting thought is because of Rahab's business, she more than likely knew some pretty important people in the town, and she probably knew some inside information about what was going on. Now, I was going to go into something I had read about the Old West and how some of these harlots of the Old West would know what was going on with the law enforcement and such. But Pastor Murray is an expert in all things Western, and I'm going to get it wrong, so I'm not going to touch it. But the idea is the same, that she would have known these men kind of intimately and would have had some inside information that other people wouldn't know. So they head there. Other possibility is that the location, that they could get on the roof, spy out the city, see what's going on, like come up with their best plan of attack. There's different options. Now, is it possible that they came for shadier reasons? I mean, I guess, but since these were two of Joshua's top guides, I would say they obviously feared the Lord, and I kind of tend to have my doubts that that's what they were doing there. They were mainly looking for a place to gather information and to sleep. Now, it's crazy, though, because it doesn't take long. I mean, that all happens in verse 1. Verse 2, it says, it was told the king of Jericho, saying, behold, men from the sons of Israel have come here tonight to search out the land. Obviously, it didn't take long for their cover to be blown. The king hears of the spies, and he sends a message to Rahab. Now, we talked about the fact that Jericho was small. I'm thinking if we had a whole entire city living on our property, we'd probably be pretty aware of what everybody was up to. And when guys come in who don't look like everybody else, they stand out a little bit. But then something kind of crazy happens, because it goes on, and the king of Jericho sent word to Rahab, saying, bring out the men who have come to you and have entered your house, for they have come to search out all the land. But the woman had taken the men and hidden them, and she said, yes, the men came to me, but I did not know where they were from. Now, if you really look closely at that, it's an interesting sequence, because it says that the king sends a message, and then Rahab hides the spies. But if you look technically at it, I think what happened was Rahab had already hid the spies. And it's interesting to me also that the king, like, he sends a message. Like I said, this was a tiny city. It was like the size of our property. And why didn't he just go? Why didn't he go with an army? And like, why, how did he know that they were spies? Well, I'm thinking we're looking at about 15 miles difference in space, and the Israelites are camped out on the Jordan Plain with 4 million people. I'm guessing they probably stood out a little bit. And we also know that he kind of knew what had happened so far. We're going to look at that later. But I wonder, why didn't he go in with an army of guys? Or why didn't he go himself? Was he nervous to find out which one of his guys knew Rahab? Like, oh, hey, Rahab, you know, maybe he didn't want to know that. Or maybe she knew him real well and he didn't want them to know that. Or maybe he was so scared of the Israelites that he didn't want to get ambushed. Scripture doesn't really tell us the answers to these questions, but we can go by what we know. So Jericho was a small town. They probably stood out. The king was confident that the men came to spy, and he was scared. But here's the craziest thing. Rahab sends the men on a wild goose chase. She just drops a huge lie, because she says, yes, the men came to me, but I did not know where they came from. It came about when it was time to shut the gate at dark that the men went out. I do not know where the men went. Pursue them quickly, for you will overtake them. Goes on and says, but she had brought them up to the roof and hidden them in the stalks of flax, which she had laid in order on the roof. So the men pursued them on the road to the Jordan, to the fords, and as soon as those pursuing them had gone, they shut the gate. Rahab sends them on a wild goose chase. She not only tells a big story, just makes it up right off the top of her head, she gives this valiant cry, pursue them quickly, for you will overtake them. It's pretty crazy, because Rahab wasn't scared. She wasn't scared to lie to the king's men. Now, what she was actually risking here wasn't just death. They would torture her. They would gouge her eyes out. Like, they would remove parts, drag her through the city, and she would die a slow, painful death. But she wasn't scared. Now, was she right to lie? I think some of us might wonder that. Wait, so she lied for them. Is that right? No. Okay. She lied, but she's not commended for that in the New Testament. She's commended for her faith, not the lie. Now, maybe some of you are remembering when we were studying Abraham. Abraham had a couple times where he told some whoppers too, saying, oh, this is my sister. You know, Rahab did something very brave, and there's a reason for it. It was because Rahab believed. Because if you continue to read. It says, "Now before they lay down, she came to them on the roof and said to the men, 'I know that the Lord has given you the land, and that the terror of you has fallen on us, and that all the inhabitants of the land have melted away before you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. When we heard it, our hearts melted away, and no courage remained in any man any longer because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God in heaven above on and on earth beneath.'" Rahab believed. It's the craziest thing. Rahab heard all the stories of what had happened, and she declares the God of Israel, the true God, to be God. The Lord your God, he is God in heaven. That completely went away against the religion she grew up in. It went against everything she grew up believing. Rahab, a pagan, hears about what God did and decides to risk her life and side with him and his people. How crazy is that? She put her life on the line to protect the spies. We won't even put our reputations on the line to share our faith. Is God doing something big that we're totally missing? Well, what are some things we can take away from this? The first thing I just jotted down when I was going through this was learn from your mistakes. I mean, you look at chapter 1, Joshua remembered how the first spy mission ended, so he made sure he wasn't going to have a repeat. Now, my wife and I had an interesting talk about this last night with the turn the other cheek and all that from the New Testament. And it's like, you know, I think what it's saying here is don't make your own mistakes over again. This isn't talking about just what other people are doing to you. Joshua knew what went wrong the first time. He's going to make sure he doesn't repeat it. And it's crazy. When you think about how scared the Israelites were, the walls of Jericho probably looked pretty big to them compared to a person. If you lined up a person next to the wall, it probably looked huge because the person was dwarfed by the wall. However, if you compared the wall to the creation of their God all around it, it probably dwarfed the wall. But the problem is they were focused on the wall. They were focused on the people. They weren't focused on the bigger picture. And our problems look big when we only compare them to our abilities, but they look a lot smaller if we compared them to the size of our God. You look at Rahab here. She didn't fear the people. She feared the Lord. Now, how are we doing about with that? I mean, think about it like this, okay? Rahab the harlot showed faith in God and became a child of God. The Israelites, who were children of God, showed doubt in God and became harlots. God showed his children his love and they chose to play the harlot. God showed a harlot his love and she chose obedience. Rahab heard about God because people were spreading the stories of what he did for Israel. And it's such a challenge to us. Are we spreading what God is doing in our lives? Are we letting people know? Are we letting our kids know what God is doing? Or do we just keep it to ourselves? We're like, "Oh, that's so nice. Thank you, God." But we don't actually share it. Or even worse, are we not even noticing it because we've become spoiled and callous to it? Another interesting thought about Rahab is she didn't stop being a harlot before she believed in God. Think about that. She was still a harlot when she heard and decided that he was the living God. Now, how's that going to play out to us? See, sometimes people think, "I want to get right with God, but I got to get all my other details in place first. As soon as I get everything under control, then I'm going to get right with God and start trusting him." That's not exactly what Rahab did. She was still a harlot when she placed her trust in God. Now, after she was saved, she most definitely changed the direction of her life because, well, we kind of know the rest of the story. And that's actually, to me, the craziest thing about Joshua 2. And this, honestly, like, I've known the story since I was a little kid, and I was, like, horribly embarrassed that it never hit me before. But Joshua 2 isn't actually really a story about Israel. It's not a story about Joshua. It's not just one of the great tales of Israel. Joshua 2 is about Rahab. The whole entire story here happened for one reason. It was to save Rahab. Because Rahab was a part of God's bigger plan. But not even Joshua, not even the priest, none of them would have had the slightest clue. I mean, honestly, Joshua was probably a little bit irritated when the spies came back and were like, look, so I'm trying to picture how this would go. So we stayed at a harlot's house. Good start to the story, right? He's like, what? And we made a deal with her. We're going to save her and her whole entire family. Joshua's probably going, are you kidding me? We weren't supposed to make deals with any of these people. What are you thinking? He's probably happy to see his spies back alive and in one piece. But at the same time, it might have been a really frustrating thing to him. But it was so important. Because Rahab does appear again. She doesn't appear in the Old Testament after Joshua 6. But she does appear again in the New Testament. It's a pretty important passage. Because she appears in Matthew 1, where we just read this little thing. And Matthew 1, verse 5 says, Salmon was the father of Boaz by Rahab. That's the same Rahab. Boaz was the father of Obed by Ruth, and Obed the father of Jesse. Jesse was the father of David the king. Rahab ends up being King David's great-grandmother. And when you look at this passage, that's why some speculate that Salmon might have been one of the spies. And you think about Rahab being saved, taken into the Israelites. I had to wonder, did the Israelites all know who she was? Did they let that go? Or was it all like, oh, you know who that is. You know what she did. But the thing is she's the most important person here. Because she was the line of Christ. Matthew 1 is the genealogy of Jesus. God was doing something so big that Israel had no idea. They thought it was all about them taking the promised land. They didn't even need to send the spies in. If you know the story of how they attacked Jericho, a spy mission had nothing to do with how Jericho fell. But God knew that Rahab needed to be spared from the attack. So God divinely arranged this whole entire ordeal to save the line of Jesus. God was doing something huge, something totally subtle, and the odds are good they missed it. Is God doing something huge in your life right now that you could be totally missing? Something maybe you're a little frustrated with and it doesn't seem like this is God's plan, so you're kind of doubting what's going on. But don't forget, we don't see the bigger picture. We don't see what he has in mind. I guarantee you, the spies weren't like, certainly this harlot is the line of our Messiah. We must save her. Not at all. They were trying to save themselves. God's doing something bigger. And if there's something in your life right now, that you're going, there is no way this is part of God's plan because this is so messed up. There's no way this person's part of God's plan. There's no way my job is part of it. There's no way the situation is part of it. Don't doubt, okay? Don't doubt for one second that God can't do something beautiful. The story of Rahab is like the most beautiful story of redemption I've ever seen. A harlot who becomes part of the line of Christ. And if you don't know this living God that Rahab has this encounter with, that she decides to place her trust in, you just need to remember, you don't need to like put all the pieces together and get everything straightened out before you come to Christ. Christ came to save sinners, not perfect people. And if he saves a harlot who probably did a few more crazy things than you, he can most definitely save you. You just need to make the decision to trust. So as we have our closing hymn, my challenge to you is this. Is there something in your life right now that you've been doubting is part of God's plan. You're doubting that he's going to do anything good with because it just seems too messed up. Have you handed it over to him? Because if you haven't, probably today's a good day to start to give that to him. But if you've never taken the first step of trusting Jesus, I'm challenging you today, just come forward and do business with God. Call out to him. Rahab wasn't in a Baptist church when she got saved. She was not in, like, perfect, oh, look at me, I've got everything together mode when she trusted Christ. But she trusted him, and he saved her. And he used her in a beautiful way that nobody saw coming. So as we sing our hymn of invitation, hey, if God's working on your heart and there's something that, man, it doesn't seem like it's part of his plan, just come forward and talk to him. Give it to him. And trust him. He's got it. And again, if you've never taken that first step of trusting Jesus, what better time than right now? So, oh, you're up here. So I saw John in the back. I was like, huh. All right. So as we sing our hymn of invitation, the altar's open. Come on up.
I have a maker. He formed my heart. Before even time began, my life was in his hand. He knows.
Father, as we leave here today, I do pray that you work on our hearts, that we look at ourselves and think about those things we doubt, those parts of our life that we don't think they're from you, and we just learn to trust, to hand them over to you, to trust your bigger plan, and to not be restricted by our limited view of what's going on. Lord, I do pray if there's anyone here today that does not know you as Savior, that you continue to work on their hearts, Lord, that you move them to make a decision to trust you with their lives. And we'll give you the praise in Jesus' name. Amen.